Welcome to ID the Future. I'm Andrew McDermott. If you're a fan of Dr. Stephen Meyer's work, you'll be pleased to know that both Darwin's Doubt and Signature in the Cell are now available in audiobook versions. To whet your appetite, we've arranged with Harper One to share an extended sample of each book. On today's episode, the second half of Chapter 1 of Signature in the Cell, narrated by Derek Shetterly.
The Origin of Biological Information. Picture six lines made up of variations of the letters A, G, T, and C. This string of alphabetic characters looks as if it could be a block of encoded information, perhaps a section of text or machine code. That impression is entirely correct, for this string of characters is not just a random assortment of the four letters A, T, G, and C, but a representation of part of the sequence of genetic assembly instructions for building a protein machine, an RNA polymerase critical to gene expression or information processing in a living cell. Now, picture six lines made up of zeros and ones. This sequence also appears to be an information-rich sequence, albeit written in binary code. As it happens, this sequence is also not just a random array of characters, but the first words of the Declaration of Independence, when in the course of human events, written in the binary conversion of the American Standard Code for Information Interchange, or ASCII. In the ASCII code, short specified sequences of zeros and ones correspond to specific alphabetic letters, numerals, or punctuation marks. Though these two blocks of encoded information employ different conventions, one uses the ASCII code, the other the genetic code, both are complex, non-repeating sequences that are highly specified relative to the functional or communication requirements that they perform. This similarity explains, in part, Dawkins's observation that the machine code of the genes is uncannily computer-like. Fair enough. But what should we make of this similarity between informational software, the undisputed product of conscious intelligence, and the informational sequences found in DNA and other important biomolecules? Introduction to an Enigma. I first encountered the DNA enigma as a young scientist in Dallas, Texas in 1985. At the time, I was working for one of the big multinational oil companies. I had been hired as an exploration geophysicist several years earlier, just as the price of oil had spiked, and just as I was graduating from college with degrees in physics and geology. My job, as the Texas oilman put it, was to look for all out in the guff. Though I had been a physics and geology student, I had enough exposure to biology to know what DNA did. I knew that it stored the instruction set, the information for building proteins in the cell, and that it transmitted hereditary traits in living things using its four-character chemical alphabet. Even so, like many scientists, I had never really thought about where DNA, or the information it contained, came from in the first place. If asked, I would have said it had something to do with evolution, but I couldn't have explained the process in any detail. On February 10, 1985, I learned that I wasn't the only one. On that day, I found myself sitting in front of several world-class scientists who were discussing a vexing scientific and philosophical question: how did the first life on Earth arise? As recently as the evening before, I had known nothing about the conference where this discussion was now taking place. I had been attending another event in town, a lecture at the Southern Methodist University by a Harvard astronomer discussing the Big Bang Theory. There, I learned of a conference taking place the following day that would tackle three big scientific questions: the origin of the universe, the origin of life, and the nature of human consciousness. The conference would bring together scientists from competing philosophical perspectives to grapple with each of these issues. The next morning, I walked into the downtown Hilton where the conference was being held and heard an arresting discussion of what scientists knew they didn't know. I was surprised to learn, contrary to what I had read in many textbooks, that the leading scientific experts on the origin of life had no satisfactory explanation for how life had first arisen. These experts, many of whom were present that weekend in Dallas, openly acknowledged that they did not have an adequate theory of what they called chemical evolution. That is, a theory of how the first living cell arose from simpler chemicals in the primordial ocean. And from their discussions, it was clear that DNA, with its mysterious arrangements of chemical characters, was a key reason for this impasse. The discussion changed the course of my professional life. By the end of that year, I was preparing to move to the University of Cambridge in England, in part to investigate questions I first encountered on that day in February. On its face, my change of course looked like a radical departure from my previous interests, and that's certainly how my friends and family took it. Oil company geophysics was a highly practical, commercially relevant form of applied science. A successful study of the subsurface of the Earth could net the company millions of dollars of revenue from the resulting discovery of oil and gas. The origin of life, however, was a seemingly intractable, even arcane, theoretical question, with little or no direct commercial or practical import. Nevertheless, at the time, the transition seemed entirely natural to me. Perhaps it was because I had long been interested in scientific questions and discoveries that raised larger philosophical issues. In college, I had taken many philosophy courses while pursuing my scientific training. But perhaps it was what I was doing at the oil company itself. By the 1980s, looking for oil required the use of sophisticated, computer-assisted seismic imaging techniques, at the time a cutting-edge form of information technology. After sending artificial seismic waves down into the earth, geophysicists would time the resulting echoes as they traveled back to the surface, and then use the information from these signals to reconstruct a picture of the subsurface of the earth. Of course, at every stage along the way, we depended heavily on computers and computer programs to help us process and analyze the information we received. Perhaps what I was learning about how digital information could be stored and processed in machines, and about how digital code could direct machines to accomplish specific tasks, made life itself, and the digital code stored in its DNA, seem less mysterious. Perhaps this made the problem of the origin of life seem more scientifically tractable and interesting. In any case, when I learned of the enigma confronting origin of life researchers and why DNA was central to it, I was hooked. A controversy that erupted at the conference added to my sense of intrigue. During a session on the origin of life, the scientists were discussing where the information in DNA had come from. How do chemicals arrange themselves to produce code? What introduced drama into what might have otherwise been a dry academic discussion was the reaction of some of the scientists to a new idea. Three of the scientists on the panel had just published a controversial book called The Mystery of Life's Origin, with a prominent New York publisher of scientific monographs. Their book provided a comprehensive critique of the attempts that had been made to explain how the first life had arisen from the primordial ocean, the so-called prebiotic soup. These scientists, Charles Thaxton, Walter Bradley, and Roger Olson, had come to the conclusion that all such theories had failed to explain the origin of the first life. Surprisingly, the other scientists on the panel, all experts in the field, did not dispute this critique. What the other scientists did dispute was a controversial new hypothesis that Thaxton and his colleagues had floated in the epilogue of their book in an attempt to explain the DNA enigma. They had suggested that the information in DNA might have originated from an intelligent source, or as they put it, an intelligent cause. Since, in our experience, information arises from an intelligent source, and since the information in DNA was, in their words, mathematically identical to the information in a written language or computer code, they suggested that the presence of information in DNA pointed to an intelligent cause. The code, in other words, pointed to a programmer. That was where the fireworks started. Other scientists on the panel became uncharacteristically defensive and hostile. Dr. Russell Doolittle of the University of California at San Diego suggested that if the three authors were not satisfied with the progress of origin of life experiments, then they should do them. Never mind that another scientist on the panel who had favored Thaxton's hypothesis, Professor Dean Kenyon of San Francisco State University, was a leading origin of life researcher who had himself performed many such experiments. It was clear that Doolittle regarded the three scientists, despite their strong credentials, as upstarts who had violated some unspoken convention. Yet it was also clear, to me at least, that the authors of the new book had seized the intellectual initiative. They had offered a bold new idea that seemed at least intuitively plausible, while those defending the status quo offered no plausible alternative to this new explanation. Instead, the defenders of the status quo were forced to accept the validity of the new critique. All they could do was accuse the upstarts of giving up too soon and plead for more time. I left deeply intrigued. If my sense of the scientific status of the problem was accurate, if there was no accepted or satisfactory theory of the origin of the first life, then a mystery was at hand. And if it was the case that evolutionary theory could not explain the origin of the first life because it could not explain the origin of the genetic information in DNA, then something that we take for granted was quite possibly an important clue in a mystery story. DNA, with its characteristic double helix shape, is a cultural icon. We see the helix in everything from music videos and modern art to science documentaries and news stories about criminal proceedings. We know that DNA testing can establish guilt, innocence, paternity, and distant genealogical connections. We know that DNA research holds the key to understanding many diseases and that manipulating DNA can alter the features of plants and animals and boost food production. Most of us know roughly what DNA is and what it does. But could it be that we do not know anything about where it came from or how it was first formed? The controversy at the conference served to awaken me to the strange combination of familiarity and mystique that surrounds the double helix and the digital code it contains. In the wake of the conference, I learned that one of the scientists who participated in the origin of life discussion was living in Dallas. It was none other than Charles Thaxton, the chemist who, with his co-authors, had proposed the controversial idea about an intelligence playing a role in the origin of biological information. I called him, and he offered to meet with me. We began to meet regularly and talk, often long after work hours. As I learned more about his critique of origin of life studies and his ideas about DNA, my interest in the DNA enigma grew. These were heady and exciting days for me as I first encountered and grappled with these new ideas. If Thaxton was right, then the classical design argument that had been dismissed first by Enlightenment philosophers such as David Hume in the 18th century, and then later by evolutionary biologists in the wake of the Darwinian Revolution, might have legitimacy after all. On a visit back home to Seattle, I described what I had been learning to one of my earlier college mentors, whose critical faculties I greatly respected, a philosophy professor named Norman Krebs. He surprised me when he told me that the scientific idea I was describing was potentially one of the most significant philosophical developments in 300 years of Western thought. Could the design argument be resuscitated based upon discoveries in modern science? And was DNA the key? As intriguing as this new line of thinking was for me, I had a growing list of questions. I wondered, what exactly is information in a biological context? When biologists referred to the sequences of chemicals in the DNA molecule as information, were they using the term as a metaphor? Or did these sequences of chemicals really function in the same way as code or text that humans use? If biologists were using the term merely as a metaphor, then I wondered whether the genetic information designated anything real, and, if not, whether the information in DNA could be said to point to anything, much less an intelligent cause. But even if the information in DNA was in some important sense similar to the information that human agents devise, it didn't necessarily follow that a prior intelligent cause was the only explanation of such information. Were there causes for information that had not yet been considered at the conference that day? Maybe some other cause of information would be discovered that could provide a better explanation for the information necessary for the origin of life. In short, I wondered, is there really evidence for the intelligent design of life? And if so, just how strong is that evidence? Was it perhaps scientifically premature or inappropriate to consider such a radical possibility, as Thaxton's critics had suggested? My concerns about this were heightened because of some of the things that Thaxton and his colleagues had written to justify their conclusion. The mystery of life's origin had made the radical claim that an intelligent cause could be considered a legitimate scientific hypothesis for the origin of life. To justify this claim, Thaxton and colleagues argued that a mode of scientific inquiry they called origins science allowed for the postulation of singular acts of intelligence to explain certain phenomena. Thaxton and his colleagues distinguished what they called origins sciences from operation sciences. Operation sciences, in their view, focus on the ongoing operation of the universe. These sciences describe recurring phenomena, like the motions of the planets and chemical reactions that can be described by general laws of physics and chemistry. Origins sciences, on the other hand, deal with unique historical events and the causes of those events, events such as the origin of the universe, the formation of the Grand Canyon, and the invention of ancient tools and agriculture. Thaxton and his colleagues argued that inferring an intelligent cause was legitimate in origins science, because such sciences deal with singular events, and the actions of intelligent agents are usually unique occurrences. On the other hand, they argued that it was not legitimate to invoke intelligent causes in operations sciences, because such sciences only deal with regular and repeating phenomena. Intelligent agents don't act in rigidly regular or law-like ways, and therefore cannot be described mathematically by laws of nature. Though their terminology was admittedly cumbersome, it did seem to capture an intuitively obvious distinction. But I still had questions. Thaxton had argued that theories in the operation sciences are readily testable against the repeating phenomena they describe. Regularity enables prediction. If a theory describing a repeating phenomenon was correct, then it should be able to predict future occurrences of that phenomenon at a specific time or under controlled laboratory conditions. Origins theories, however, do not make such predictions because they deal with unique events. For this reason, Thaxton thought that such theories could not be tested. Theories about the past can produce plausible but never decisive conclusions. As a geophysicist, I knew that Earth scientists often formed hypotheses about past events, but I wasn't sure that such hypotheses were never testable or decisive. We have very good scientific reasons for thinking that dinosaurs existed before humans, and that agriculture arose after the last ice age. But if Thaxton was right, then such conclusions about the past were merely plausible, no more than possibly true, and completely untestable. Yet I wondered if a hypothesis about the past couldn't be tested, if there is no way to judge its strength or compare it against that of competing hypotheses, then why regard the claims of historical or origins theories as significant? It is provocative to claim that the evidence from DNA and our best scientific reasoning point strongly to an intelligent cause of life. It is not very interesting to claim that it is possibly true, plausible, that DNA owes its origin to such cause. Many statements are merely plausible or possibly true, but that doesn't mean we have any reason to think them likely to be true. Rigorous scientific testing usually provides evidence-based reasons for making such claims or for preferring one hypothesis over another. Absent such testability, I wasn't sure how significant or scientific Thaxton's argument really was. Even so, I was deeply fascinated with the whole issue. In September 1985, I learned that I was to be laid off from my oil company job as the price of oil had dropped from $32 to $8 per barrel. I was strangely relieved. I used the rather generous severance the company provided to begin supporting myself as a freelance science writer. But soon after I started, I also learned that I had received a Rotary scholarship to study in England. The following spring, a thin airmail letter arrived, informing me that I had been accepted to study the history and philosophy of science at the University of Cambridge. This course of study would enable me to explore many of the questions that had long fascinated me at the intersection of science and philosophy. It would also allow me to investigate the questions that had arisen in my discussions with Charles Thaxton. What methods do scientists use to study biological origins? Is there a distinctive method of historical scientific inquiry? And what does the scientific evidence tell us about the origin of biological information and how life began? Is it possible to make a rigorous scientific argument for the intelligent design of life? I eventually completed a PhD dissertation on the topic of origin of life biology. In it, I was able to investigate not only the history of scientific ideas about the origin of life, but also questions about the definition of science and about how scientists study and reason about the past. The current controversy. I couldn't have known as I was leaving for England, but the two main questions I had about Dr. Thaxton's idea, is it scientific and how strong is the evidence for it, would resurface with a vengeance 20 years later at the center of an international controversy. Indeed, one that would engage the attention of the mainstream media, the courts, the scientific establishment, and the publishing and movie industries. In 2005, a federal judge would rule that public school science students in Dover, Pennsylvania, could not learn about the idea that life pointed to an intelligent cause, because the idea was neither scientific nor testable. Mainstream scientific organizations, such as the National Academy of Sciences and American Association for the Advancement of Science, would issue similar pronouncements. In 2006 and 2007, a spate of books with titles like The God Delusion and God is Not Great would argue there is no evidence for design in biology, and therefore no good evidence for the existence of God. According to Oxford evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins and other new atheists, the lack of evidence for design has made the idea of God tantamount to a delusion. In 2008, the controversy surrounding what is now known as the theory of intelligent design moved into movie theaters, video stores, and candidate press conferences. And this year, with the celebration of the 200th anniversary of Darwin's birth and the 150th anniversary of the publication of On the Origin of Species, the main question that Darwin himself addressed, was life designed or does it merely appear designed, has reemerged as scientists, scholars, teachers, and media commentators evaluate his legacy. Yet, in all of this discussion, from Dover to Dawkins to Darwin's big anniversary, there has been very little discussion of DNA. And yet for me and many other scientists and scholars, the question of whether science has refuted the design argument or resuscitated it depends critically upon the central mystery of the origin of biological information. This book examines the many successive attempts that have been made to resolve this enigma, the DNA enigma, and will itself propose a solution.
That concludes Chapter 1 of the audiobook version of Signature in the Cell by Dr. Stephen Meyer. It's available at Amazon, Audible, and all good online and offline book retailers. Pick up a copy today and enjoy the book again, or for the first time. For more about the book, visit signatureinthecell.com. And look out for other episodes of the podcast where we highlight the audiobook version of Darwin's Doubt, The Explosive Origin of Animal Life, and The Case for Intelligent Design. For ID the Future, I'm Andrew McDermott. Thanks for tuning in. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.